Writer George Saunders rocked the literary world with his latest collection of short stories, 10th of December. This is a set of stories that touches on all kinds of issues, ranging from abuse to drugs to war and neglect. He teaches creative writing at Syracuse University. He's the winner of a genius grant from the MacArthur Fellows Program. George Saunders is a National Book Award finalist, and he joins us in our studios right now. And it's like an angel has come through the door to bail me out here, George. So good to have
you
here.
So many times people have said that to me.
Yes. But none more heartfelt than me here this morning.
No,
so nice to have
you here.
Thanks for
having me.
Thanks for coming in so
My
early
pleasure.
With us today
I'm
here.
Sorry.
Well, I thought I'd begin not with 10th of December, but with this commencement address that you gave to Syracuse University last year where you teach. I was wondering, and as someone who's done this before, how tough of an assignment is giving a commencement
address?
Well,
you know, it's the toughest.
It's the toughest.
Yeah. It's people who are kind of nodding off and waiting to get in line and get their things.
Maybe you want to go out and play and you have to get through with something serious.
Yeah. Here. You know, I got an email from a Syracuse student recently saying, I didn't realize that was such a good speech, man, because we were kind of hungover. And, you know, so it's a tough gig. But, you know, that one I had done sort of a practice run a few years before when our daughter graduated middle school. The school asked me to do it. And I said to my daughter, is that all right with you? She said, sure. So that's a really tough gig when it's your daughter
middle
and their
school
friends.
Too.
Yeah. So
did you offer the same theme up for the middle schoolers?
I did. I mean, that was the first draft was the middle schoolers, and partly because I kind of burned through all the nonsense you come, you know, to thine own self be true.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And with these kids that were my daughter and her friends, I didn't want to be vacuous. So I thought, well, really, what do I know at this point at 50-something years old? And you know, they're better looking than me. They're going to a better school. So I have nothing to tell them, except one thing I did have on them was about 40 years. And, you know, and when you look back, I did so many stupid things as a kid, so many idiotic things. I don't really regret those. Those are kind of fun. They make a good story afterwards. But when I looked at what I really was sorry about, what I would really change, it was just a handful of times where I had, through, you know, fear or anxiety or something, failed to be kind to somebody who could have used a kind word.
And, you know, in this story that you tell, and it got picked up on the net and it got sent all over the place, people really latched onto it, this notion of failures of kindness. And that theme, you talked about a girl in high school, I believe.
It was grade school in Chicago.
And you described her so well. Tell us a little more about her and how you felt as you look back on her.
Well, she was just this girl who showed up in maybe fifth or sixth grade, just sort of a...
We've all had that.
Yeah, she just came in, and she just was a half step off. You know, she had these kind of those cat-eye glasses that at that time were the kiss of death, and a very nervous girl. And she had one particular mannerism where she would sort of, when she got really nervous, she'd take a strand of her hair into her mouth, which didn't, you know, play well in at that point. And it was sort of an interesting thing because nobody – it wasn't bullying. It wasn't overt, but it was just constant little things that people would say to her and rejections of her and, you know, and I noticed it. And at that time, you know, it was Catholic school and I was a pretty good Catholic kid, so I knew what Jesus would have done. Mm-hmm. And so I think why I remembered it was just the difference between what I knew I should do and what I did, which was essentially nothing. I never teased her. In fact, I know a few times I would sort of try to talk to her, you know, but
yeah.
Just as a grown-up to see, wouldn't it have been something to be heroically kind, you know, to really intervene or really try to do something? And, of course, in the heat of battle, you don't do it. But and then she, at some point, she just moved, and that was it. You know, there was no catastrophic thing, but she lingers in my memory even now.
You know, you sort of talked about her and, you know, this sense of seeing her and sort of pulling the hair into her mouth and doing her thing, and you sort of imagined her going home from a day of school and talking to mom, and mom sort of sitting back and saying, well, honey, how was your day in school today? And she would have said,
she'd just say, it was good, fine, you know, making friends. Yeah. I mean, in that situation, the kid, one of the curses is that the kid doesn't really know what's happening to her and maybe doesn't have the wherewithal to say, you know, I'm struggling. Yeah. I actually, you know, that part of the speech kind of bleeded over. There was another kid in our school who, this was maybe in 1970, and his parents were sort of markedly older than the other parents. They'd been through World War II. So this kid's curse was that he was always talking in 40s slang in 1970, you know, and it just stood out. But I saw him one time. His mom picked him up from school, and they had a real close, tight moment, and I thought, oh, she doesn't know. She doesn't know, you know, how much trouble he's going through.
You know, it is amazing. You think, I have a 15-year-old, so I've just been through some of those years, and man, Those years are so hard.
They're so hard.
And you're right. Those heroic acts of kindness you're talking about are so elusive and so rare. And why?
Yeah.
But they are.
They really are hard. And I think one of the blessings of getting older is maybe time slows down a little bit, you know, and you're not quite as afraid of being, you know, behind the pack or whatever. And you can kind of see those things with clarity. I had a talk with somebody the other day who said a really interesting thing about what's happened in the country, say, since the 80s. Which is that a lot of these virtues like kindness and sympathy and compassion and patience have kind of gotten relegated to soft status. You know, these are just – they're not real things. They're just weaknesses. And, you know, aggression and certainty and are positive sort of manly virtues. And I think that's that kind of might be part of the reason this speech sort of resonated, because it was sort of me standing up in front of people kind of saying, you know, I think this kindness thing is actually a very objectifiable, solid thing that we're lacking.
Yeah.
You know, you think about Lincoln or something like that. That was one of the kindest men, you know, able to be willing to be taunted and kidded and the whole thing in the service of good. So it's a very American thing, actually.
Well, as someone who's been through this sort of experience of trying to come up with a theme for a commencement address, I just did it here at UMKC 6 months ago. How did you latch upon this theme of failures of kindness? Where did it come from in your mind that you were able to hang on to it, George, and sort of latch on to it?
I think it was just thinking of my daughter and her friends and saying, well, all right, if I really do have 8 minutes here to say something urgent to them, let's cut out the BS and go right for the thing. And that seemed to me the one thing, you know, it's a thing you have to learn through time. But maybe I could give them a little head start. And so everything else seemed kind of facile, you know, like do good work. Okay, sure, you know, whatever.
It all seems so that way.
It
trivial
does.
And what can you say to these people that's going to resonate in any way whatsoever?
Right. Keep your credit card, you know, whatever. But the one thing I thought was, since most advice at that age goes in one ear and out the other, I don't even remember the speech that I got when I graduated.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that you could get their attention by confessing weakness a little bit, by saying, you know, this old fart in front of you has a regret. I made a big mistake in my life. And you could almost feel the energy go, really, you did? Now, this is interesting, you know. And then you drop it on them. And it's also not a big mistake. It's a failure of omission, really, rather than commission.
Yeah.
And somehow I think it was just that, I don't know, but I had the feeling that if you were honest, really honest, and vulnerable, they would listen, and it seemed that they kind of did.
How did the speech sort of pick up its sense of momentum? What happened to it that got the attention that it wound up getting?
It was very strange because I did it in May, and like I said, a third of the crowd seemed to be asleep. And so, you know, I kind of, now I get to have my summer.
Yeah.
And just went home, really. And then, you know, when this book first came out in last January, there was a piece in the Times about the book by a wonderful writer named Joel Lovell, who was at the Times. So we stayed in touch. And at one point, I said, oh, I have to do this graduation speech. He said, oh, send me a copy when you're done. So I sent it, and he posted it on the New York Times blog.
Mm.
And we were actually on vacation visiting my mother-in-law in South Dakota, and I started getting emails, like just so many. And I thought, what the heck's going on? And it had apparently, you know, gone viral off of their website. And, you know, it's funny to be the person who's going viral has really no experience of it because I've already read it, you know, and all you get is this second wave indicators that something's going on.
Well, people were writing you with their own examples from their own lives of their own
beautiful
examples of failures of kindness, right? And
yes,
lots of things where they wish they could go back and do it again.
And many of them paralleled the story in the speech about there was this kid in fourth grade or this kid in high school that I should have helped. It was kind of moving to see that was not just my experience. There were a lot of people who had that kind of thing. So my thought was maybe that's when in our life we fall away from ourselves for the first time. You know, that we're kind of pretty comfortable thinking of ourselves as good people and people of integrity and strength. And maybe the first time we disappoint ourselves, it looms large in our memory. I think that
you do sort of wonder, I mean, what is it about us that even at times like that, like you were saying, that you knew what Jesus would have done, you knew what better people might have done it in a moment like that, and yet you still didn't do it.
Yeah.
And of course, I didn't do it either at different times in my life. What's up with that? I mean, what is it, the peer pressure thing? What stops us from doing the right thing? And it's a bigger thing. It's easy to dismiss it as being, yeah, it wasn't that big of a deal. Yeah, in some ways it was, you know?
Not to
make it feel worse.
No. Let me just sob here a little bit.
Yeah.
No, but in the speech, what I suggest is that if you look at it closely, because it's going to happen again. In other words, it's not like I'm cured of it. I mean, that's not the, or any of us are cured of it. But I think it has to do with something maybe biological, which is we really come into the world thinking that we're the first person ever. You know, all these other schmucks just happen to be stage setting for us. Yeah. The world didn't really start till we got here. And also, we think that we're going to be here forever. You know, mm-hmm. that, for those other people. We tend to think in our thought streams that we're central. You know, everybody else is sort of in our show, basically.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, just the way we're made. But it's also not true. You know, we know that all those things are false. Our own centrality in the world, it's actually not scientifically true.
Yeah.
So we probably, for our Darwinian reasons, we walk around thinking that we're the big cheese. So then in a critical moment like that, your mind says, you know, your status is going to suffer. You're going to go lower. And your belief in yourself as a separate unit is so strong that your whole body won't allow you to do
it. You know, sometimes, though, I just in a converse sort of way, I find myself sometimes at parties. You go to a party, and I end up sometimes gravitating to the person who sort of seems to be off to the side, not talking to anybody. And, you know, it just sort of seems like that's where I wind up, and sometimes you sort of get stuck there sometimes.
Yeah, no.
Like, why did I do it for so long? And the party wasn't as much fun because I sort of felt this obligation to sort of talk to someone when, I don't know.
Well, this is a great point because, you know, if you make this the kindness speech and you're in danger of becoming the kindness guy, which you don't, you know, then you can't shoplift anymore. And, you know,
you aren't up to that kind of load responsibility.
But,
right?
But even in the original story, I mean, part of it was I did make overtures to her a couple times and she wasn't having it. And also it was sort of like you could feel that you could get yourself into an even rougher spot,
yes,
and even put her in harm's way, you know. So this, what I love about this issue is that kindness is sort of we mistake it for niceness, which I don't think is correct, and it's kind of a gateway virtue. I think if you get up in the morning and say, all right, I'm going to be kind today. Well, immediately you should say, what does that mean exactly? Well, I'm going to try to be helpful to people. All right, good luck with that. You know, you go into a coffee shop and somebody's a little grouchy with you. How do you help that person?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you just shut up, you know.
God forbid the girl you're talking about sort of becomes a little dependent on you and starts reaching out and wants to hang out with you on the playground, and that ain't going to work.
No, exactly,
you know,
exactly. So I think this thing, kindness is a great idea, but when you get into it, I think it's like a trap door, and it leads you into really interesting, deeper spiritual issues like awareness, awareness of your own phenomenon. What's your ego doing? You know, are you helping this person out of some ego need? So I was lucky it was an 8-minute speech because I could sort of cut it when I got to the hard part.
You did it
in
8 minutes?
Yeah, it was, I think, 8 or 10, something like that.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
That's even better. I was supposed to speak last night to a group for 20 minutes. I ended up going 30, and I looked at my watch. I thought, I had no idea I'd gone over by, you know.
Well, what is that thing about I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have time for that. Yeah.
Let's take a break. George Saunders is here. He's the author of 10th of December, all kinds of literary praise for this book. We'll talk about it in our second half. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation with former NAACP Director Julian Bond or our conversation about the rise of the metropolis, you can find them on all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. We're visiting this hour with a writer, George Saunders. He's made great waves in the literary world with his new collection of short stories, 10th of December. We're going to talk about that this hour. If you want to join our conversation with George, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. You can tweet us at @kcuruptodate. George, you've taught creative writing at Syracuse for how long?
Since 97.
97.
So, yeah.
How do you find, I guess the obvious question, how do you find time to write when you're engaged in grading papers and all that stuff?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. You know, it's been kind of a blur, but it's a pretty good schedule. You know, at this point, I got that MacArthur in 2006, and so I kind of negotiated and got half time. So time's not really a big problem. Yeah. And when our kids were little, my first book, I wrote it at work as a tech writer. So I was stealing time and kind of a little bit getting charged by the the fear, I guess. So when our kids were little, they would come in and out, and I kind of like writing in a chaotic atmosphere. So,
and you said sometimes your students actually sort of feed the ideas and feed the machine a little bit.
Oh, very much, yeah. We got this year, when I go back home, we've got 600 applications waiting, and there's six spots. So there's
for your creative writing program.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In fiction, and they're so good, these kids. So you can't phone it in, and you have to really be engaged with them. So if you ever get a little, I mean, you're a very young guy, but when you're middle-aged, the brain starts to kind of, you're clean. Foghat is the
calcify,
only band.
Calcify, you're talking about.
Calcify, yeah.
I'm living with that right now.
Yeah. So to go in with these kids every day and have your lazy assumptions challenged is gold. To see their enthusiasm for writing. They're just at that stage where they're going, oh, yeah, I maybe can represent this beautiful world in language. So you can't help but get fed by that.
You know, I teach journalism here, mm-hmm. and you get the question sometimes, you're teaching kids and you don't know where the journalism world's going. Are there going to be jobs out there? Creative writing certainly falls into the same sort of category. How do you deal with that?
Well, we just disavow. We're not a job. I mean, we basically tell them. I do a talk where I lay out the sort of finances of a book, and it's always a very depressing day. You know, here's how much you get. Here's how much the government gets. Here's how much your agent gets. But it kind of sets them square that it's a vocation. It's a labor of love. It's an art form. And so that's kind of clarifying. We're not claiming to do anything,
Walk us through that. How much do you get for a book these days? Book of fiction.
Yeah.
What's the agent get? What's the government
well,
get?
Well, it's all over the place in terms of how much you get.
Of course.
But
yeah.
the basic thing, I live in New York State, so 40% goes to the government because you're paying in advance. And the agent gets 10 or 15 or 20. And the payments come in four chunks. One when you sell it, one when the manuscript is delivered, one when the hardcover comes out, one when the paperback comes out. So, mm-hmm. Like my first book was a book of stories, which was actually I got $45,000 for it, which is actually pretty good in those days, back in the '90s.
How did you manage $45,000 for a book like that?
I'd had stories in the New Yorker, which sort of helped.
And that's the cachet that gets you a little something.
Yeah, and they do a sort of bidding war. But so at the time, I'm working as a tech writer, and I'm like $45,000. And but you take half of it away, and then you divide it up in four payments and spread it out over 2.5 years, and pretty soon it's not a job that you get rich at, but it's so deeply rewarding in other ways that it's
you know this notion. And again, having spent time with your book and sort of to use the word creative in connection with your writing is an understatement. I mean, it's really you're just sort of connecting all kinds of things and going everywhere with it. And yet, this idea that you used to be a tech writer, I can only begin to imagine what kind of struggle that was for you, just based on knowing you through your book a little bit.
I was trained in geophysics. I got a degree at the School of Mines in Colorado. So that was more of I didn't really even know you could be a writer.
And who was the other famous writer who's
well, Vonnegut was a tech writer.
Vonnegut, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So in a way, it was kind of me being inept. I didn't realize that if you like something, you might try to do it for a job. I just was kind of wandering. But I had a geology teacher in high school who really liked me and actually got me in college. I mean, literally got me into college. So I was trying to follow in his footsteps. So became an engineer. And then when our kids came, I was a tech writer. And actually, I think it was great, because in that you're getting access to a world that would clam up if a journalist came in, We were doing a lot of environmental remediation work, and before that I was in the oil business. And if a journalist walks into those situations, everybody sits up straight But when you're part of it, you see the way power actually proceeds. You see the way that oppression occurs.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because you mentioned that in the Star, Kansas City Star story on Sunday that ran about you. What do you mean oppression occurs? What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, the easiest example would be when I was in Asia, we were working for an American company that did exploration geophysics. So we would go into these in Sumatra and do oil prospecting. And so often you get to a place where there was a virgin rainforest that was a natural preserve, but it could be negotiated, with a few dollars on the side. So then we're in the virgin rainforest. Lots of kind of, partying and kind of raucous treatment of the locals. None of the money was going back to the people whose fields we were plundering. So that just that kind of standard stuff. Mm-hmm. And so for a young guy to kind of sit in on that and watch it was really interesting because the people doing it were great people. They're my best friends,
Different people away from that kind of situation, I imagine.
Well, yeah, I think, or even in that situation, that nobody was saying, yeah, 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 let's rip off these third world people. They were just sort of, maybe they were helping them to exploit their resources, or they weren't thinking about it. But it gave me a kind of a complicated idea of how power works. You know, maybe the cliche is the man is taking advantage of the little guy. And of course, that's kind of true, but there are layers there. And so for a fiction writer, it's great to be mindful of the layers.
But were you yearning to bust out of that, though, with your sort of creative energy? Were you trying to break down the wall, or was it not that big of a struggle for you?
I just always knew I was kind of weird. You know, so I would have, you know, a lot of energy. I had a lot of fun, but I don't think I was yearning to break out. I got sick when I was over there, and that was sort of the breaking point. I went swimming in a river in Sumatra was swimming along and looked up, and there was a pipeline, and on the pipeline there was about 200 monkeys kind of pooping down into the water. And I thought, oh, I wonder if this is okay. And it wasn't. So
it wasn't okay.
Got so sick that it just kind of ruptured everything. And I thought, you know, I'm not really that good of an engineer. What do I really like? And writing had always been it. So I quit and kind of came home and beatniked around for 4 or 5 years.
Did you have kids at that point?
No, totally single.
This is prior to all that.
Prior, yeah.
And then you connected with a book or two. Is that?
No, I mean, actually there was, went to, you know, I was at a wild party in Amarillo, Texas, and it was making me uncomfortable. So I drifted over, and there was a People magazine with an article about Raymond Carver and the Syracuse MFA program, which I had never even heard of that before. So, and I was doing nothing. I'm making no money and kind of spiraling downwards. So I applied and got in. So I went to Syracuse when I was about 27.
How did you get in?
You know, it's the same way we do it now. You just submit 40 pages of fiction. I'd been writing on the side a little bit.
Yeah.
And so I got this miraculous, life-changing call from Tobias Wolff, who's a great American short story writer. And I had just come back, I think, from a shift at the slaughterhouse. And my dad said, this guy, Wolff, called you. And called him up, and he said, would you like to come study writing with us? And we'll pay for it, you know, for 2 years. So packed up and went out there. And then
that must have been one of those incredible moments for
I remember it as like it was yesterday. It was such a generous, you know, just a hand reaching across the country and reaching down to where I was and saying, you know, come on, we'll give you a chance.
He has no idea who you are, really, and he's reaching out and grabbing you, and suddenly the door opens
right
up.
Yeah. And in fact, he knew enough about me that he had to do a special intervention with the administration because my academic background was so strange. And they said, we'd just like to let us try this and see if it works. So. And then when I got there, I met my wife, and we got engaged in 3 weeks in the romantic Syracuse ambiance. And then, but then it was another. You know, I wasn't a quick learner, so it was another 7 years before or eight before I had a book out. You know, by then we had our two kids. So it was a really, you know, not a child prodigy by any stretch.
Hand to mouth, tough, typical writer thing trying to make it work.
I mean, it wasn't the gulag, but it had its moments of roughness.
George Saunders, the great writer, is with our guest today. He's the author of 10th of December, a collection of short stories that's gotten all kinds of attention. A big story about George in Sunday's Kansas City Star. You said something interesting about viewpoints and the idea that everybody thinks that authors have this viewpoint they want to cram down everybody's throat. But you say, George, that for you, that isn't the case at all. In fact, you told the newspaper, I'm not really trying to say anything. You try not to have, I mean, are you saying you don't try to have any intention at all? Because a lot of people are going to be so surprised to hear that.
That's the plan, is to have as little as possible. And, you know, I always compare it to going on a date with somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have sort of an intention, it will go well. That's, you know, and you won't be dull. But if you show up with index cards, you know, 7:05, compliment her outfit, 7:15, ask about her mother, then it's instantly a condescending relationship that's going to be insulting for the person on the other side.
I thought great writers planned it all out.
Some do, I'm sure. I'm sure some do. But I think, you know, that old cliche about no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. But also, you know, you have to look at your own limitations. And for me, when I have an idea, a big idea, then when I go into the story and just execute that idea, it's always dull. I don't know why. It's just my wiring.
So instead, you sort of pull at a strand, you said, and sort of try to make something of it.
It's kind of like, you know, in biology class when you have that seed crystal, you look at it and it starts growing on its own very naturally. So for me, if I can get some little fragment of a funny idea or a paragraph or two or a couple lines of dialogue, then really try to keep the big ideas at bay as long as I can. Just start messing around with that and seeing it. You know, it's almost like if you said, once upon a time, there was a dog with two heads. All right, that's kind of stupid, but I wonder, did the two heads get along? You know, what happens at mealtime? So the natural curiosity that comes out of any sentence is usually enough to kind of get the story going. So my experience is, if I do it that way, at least the story is kind of respecting its own energy. And I'm a little baffled by it most of the time. I'm not sure where it's going, which means that as a reader, you're not sure. And we're kind of huddled together looking at this thing, trying to experience it. So that's the theory anyway.
I mean, your stories, they're different. I mean, I haven't read stories like yours before. They're different. And that, you mentioned the word energy. They do seem to have an energy of their own that maybe comes in part at least because of that. And that strikes me as such a counterintuitive idea, because the temptation for writers these days is to grab the big idea.
Yes.
And to say something that's so profound that the world wakes up and pays attention to George
right.
Saunders for the first time in a way it had never done before. But you're avoiding that, though.
Well, or I mean, that would still be the aspiration, but the idea is you can't get there from a point of condescension. You have to – I always think of it like, all right, I'm just concentrating on the sentence here, and all these big ideas and themes and political content, they're out like little forest animals, you know. They'll come out, but not if you look at them. You got to kind of let them come out of their own accord. And because I'm a political person, and because I'm a person interested in the world, of course, the story will eventually have something like that. But, you know, Einstein had this great line. He said, no worthy problem is ever solved in the plane of its original conception. So the idea with that is if the writer knows what he's going to do and then does it, he's lost. But to go into it sort of with a spirit of adventure is, you know. But that's also partly, I think, because of the way we're taught writing. You know, when you're in school, what was the theme? What was Mr. Hemingway trying to convey?
And what's your conclusion? Where's this
exactly.
thing going to end?
Yeah. And really, you know, a good story, like a good movie or a good song, it's like a carnival ride. You know, you don't quite know why you're thrilled. You don't know really what's going on, but when you come out, you're kind of jangly. You know, you're more alive than you were when you went in. And I would argue that you're also a little more – this is maybe thin ice, but I think you're a little bit better. You're a little more awake to the fact that you're actually alive. You're a little more – you're taking more notice of the actual physical world just for maybe, you know, a couple hours after the experience. I don't think that's not a trivial thing, and to get it takes a lot of commitment and kind of fearlessness on the part of the artist.
So when you write some of your stories, I got your book sitting next to me here. When you write some of these things, then you're saying you don't know where they're going to go when you start.
Almost never. In that book, never.
This is a jazzy sort of improvisation thing that you're sort of recommending to the world here.
Well, it's sort of like improvisation in a studio where you can go back and edit. You know, so I'll do like hundreds and hundreds of passes through the story. So you're improvising hundreds of times, and then you're selecting the best of, and
in the same story.
Yeah. Like there's one in here that took me, I wrote for over 14 years. It's a 60-page story, you know, and so.
Which one is it?
The Semple Girl Diaries.
So
it's not exactly improv. It's improv, but then you've got the great privilege of going back and piecing things together. Or with me, it's often trying to figure out what's the next beat of the story. And then writing four or five versions to see which one has the most energy, and going, oh, that's the right, you know, that's the right path. So it's very improvised.
I wanted to ask you about this Escape from Spider-Man book, which absolutely fascinated me. This idea of you have your subject who turns out to be a bad guy, and he's a reformed criminal. He's enlisted to help, you know, test drugs that chemically alter a person's ability to feel love and happiness. And this is a pretty wild story. I mean, it's just this guy is being tested upon. Other people are being tested. He's being checked for how he's reacting to the women that he's been who are also being tested. And they make love. And there's relationship there that seemingly starts and then falters. What was the fragment, George, that got this thing going?
Yeah, I had a lot of times when I'm writing, I'll take on a voice that's about 20% less articulate than I am in person, just for comic effect, kind of a working class voice. So I just finished a story like that, and I was a little bored with it. And I thought, you know, I want to write something like kind of Dickensian or Henry James, something in a big voice. So I just wrote something. I wrote some prose that was a little more 19th century. And I thought, okay, how do I get that into a story? And I just flashed it. Oh, it's a drug. Same guy is speaking the lower voice and the higher voice, what happens between those two things? Oh, he gets dosed with something. Just an impulse. And it kind of tickled me, honestly. You know, I thought, oh, that's kind of fun. What if our pharmaceutical industry was a little better than it is now and could do things like make you more articulate with the drug? And then, of course, the treasure chest springs opening. Ooh, what else could they do? Ah, they could make you fall in love at will, you know. So it really, it was just the boredom with the voice I was writing in. And then I went up into a higher register and then just very mechanically thought, well, how did that happen?
Because it's not so far-fetched that you can't connect to it. You know, it's sort of like this new movie out I just saw this weekend, Her,
yeah.
Which is the guy falling in love with the computer. You can sort of connect with the idea that maybe someday the drugs will be there and you want to feel love, you feel love. You want to be depressed, you be depressed, right. Whatever you want to.
Well, I often wonder, you know, if somebody could say to you, tell us about the very best day you ever had in your life, the best you ever felt. Okay, now we're going to sample that. We just got it. Do you want to feel like that every day the rest of your life? It's kind of a tough question, because if it was a really good day and if you were feeling so good that you were unbelievably generous and witty and all these things, it'd be strange to choose not to be, you know, to not be that would be kind of odd, but it also would be kind of weird to choose to be it. So I don't know that we're there yet, but you know, on another level, when I was a kid one time, I got a terrible flu, and I just had that experience of the flu made me so unhappy. Everything seemed yucky. You know, my house was stupid.
Yeah.
My town. And that's, in a sense, that's a pharmaceutical experience. You know, we're always making the world with our mind, actually. And
so you wrote this thing and wrote it, and then you're going back and trimming and cutting and sort of reshaping and molding, and you're really spending some time with this thing.
Oh, yeah. That was about maybe 7-month deal. But
you put it down, pick it up, put it down.
That one I kind of went straight through because it felt kind of hot at the time, you know. What I did with that one is I expanded up to about 200 pages, and then cut it back because I didn't like where it went, so I just cut it back and kept it at that 25 page length. But it's just a big experiment, you know, to see here's an idea. Now let's see where it takes us. And the only way I can get there is by just line to line tweaking.
But you have to have a certain level of self confidence to be able to think. You can, A, spend the time on it, and, B, you can reel it back in once you're 200 pages in, George.
Right. Well, partly it comes from having done it for a long time. And, you know, it's almost like if you do that once and have a good result, you never forget it. It's in your DNA, and you're dissatisfied if you haven't, you know, gotten to that point.
Yeah.
And also, you know, with my teaching, you're always reading these great masters, you know, Chekhov and Tolstoy and Gogol.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, my God, I would kill to just write one story a fraction as good as that. So it does sort of develop patience and a little bit of realism about it. You know, I mean, the artistic practice is so wonderful because it just doesn't lie to you, you know.
George Saunders is our guest. He's the author of 10th of December, a book that's gotten all kinds of acclaim. He'll be speaking and talking about his work at 7 tonight at Unity Temple on the Country Club Plaza. To grab a ticket, call our friends at Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. Again, 913-384-3126. I was struck in the story that, again, came out about you in the paper on Sunday. When you were in third grade, you connected with a certain writer's voice. Was it Esther Forbes?
Forbes, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about that, because I was just so blown away by this notion that in third grade, you were tinkering with writing and wanting to emulate someone else's work that way. Tell us about that.
Well, I had this nun that I loved, Sister Lynette. She was one of those hot nuns, you know, and a real sweet young girl, you know. And she just, I think she saw that I was a pretty good reader. So she was really skillful, and she pulled me aside and she said, you know, there's a book I think you should read, but I'm not sure you're really ready for it. It's kind of for older kids. And
yeah, of course, boy, that's motivation.
Yeah. And then she said something that was even better if you're Catholic. She said, you know, some of us were talking about this in the convent. I'm like, they talk about me in the convent? So anyway, she hands over this copy of Johnny Tremaine that she checked out for me from the library, and a beautiful hardcover with a big old Caldecott sticker on it.
Neat.
And she handed, you know, a lot of reverence. She handed it and she said, I hope you enjoy this. And so, you know, I was so moved by that. And took it home, and Esther Forbes is a really wonderful stylist. She's got you can tell she's paid attention to every phrase, you know. And somehow that language just got inside my head, and I was kind of, you know, walking around school pretending to be Johnny Tremaine. He's got a crippled right hand, I don't know if other people do this or not, but I was sort of imagining I would be living my little day there in Chicago in school and retelling it in her voice, or trying to anyway, you know. And it was such a deep, rich time, you know.
You were in third grade.
I was in third grade.
Graders, that is weird, George.
It's weird. I'm weird.
Don't do that,
yeah,
you know.
No. And, of course, no one would ever know it. I was all internal. But there was just something real that it's set in revolutionary Boston, and that was so real to me. You know, I could sort of spend hours just imagining myself walking around it, and it was a very strange thing. But, you know, again, because I don't – on the other level, I'm kind of a lunkhead because having had that experience, one, I didn't recognize it as anything special. And two, I didn't connect that with what I might do for a livelihood. I just thought, oh, yeah, that was fun. I'm sure everybody who reads this book would have the same experience.
Do you think your students today at Syracuse are having those experiences of sort of being transported by a book in the same way that we were as kids? Are you seeing that or
oh,
not?
Oh, yeah, very
oh,
much.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not the answer I expected.
No, I don't think that changed. I think it's neurological, actually. I think certain people are wired to language, and certain people are wired to image or whatever. But any one of my students, if you said, what was your first and most intense experience with a book, they have, you know, great answers. Different writers, but
yeah.
I think it's just, I think, you know, what I really think is, of course, I'm a little biased, but if you think about what makes a human being and those little micro fluctuations of thought and emotion and nuance and habit and all that, I think prose is an amazing way of affirming those things. You know, in other words, mm-hmm. saying, if I've had a neurotic thought or whatever thought, you've probably had some version of it. And so Tolstoy, who died all the years ago, can write a scene of the birth of his child. And me reading it in 1987 go, oh, my God, that's just what I went through.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really magical thing, very hopeful kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, you say that you have this weird aversion to language that's too nondescript.
Mm-hmm.
What bothers you about language that's too nondescript? I guess maybe that's an obvious question for maybe an obvious answer for an author, but what bothers you about it?
I don't know. I mean, in that same period that I was reading John and Tremaine, we had these sort of cookie cutter, reading textbooks, and they were so bland. I thought, you know, kind of like, you know, Jim was a cheerful redheaded boy with a love for horses. And something in me just, almost like if you heard off-key music, I just like, why are you writing like that? Don't you see this
beautiful world? It's Kenny G, right?
Yeah. Don't you see this beautiful world around you? And don't you see that language is inadequate to the task of describing it? You know, mm-hmm. So I think it's just a visceral kind of thing.
Well, your book is such a testament to not cookie cutter. It's just completely unconventional and a different way. And so clearly you're wired that way.
Yeah, I think neurologically and also in terms of my experience, you know, I didn't come through. I wasn't an English undergrad major. Read all kinds of weird stuff that I thought was good and maybe wasn't. came to writing with kind of a 1920s idea of the function of it. So it's almost like a musician who was trained by crazy people. I mean, when he goes to play, it's going to be a little bit off kilter. So a lot of my task over the years of writing has been to take this kind of weird off-kilter product and just move it close enough to the center so that people can understand it and so I can communicate. But in this way, the early experience of working and being out in the world has been, I guess, both a help and a hindrance. You know, the stuff is weird because of that. But also, like, I've never written a novel, partly because I don't quite have the confidence that I might have if I'd started studying the novel earlier and so on.
God, I just think that's so difficult to do, to do what you're doing and writing in a way that's, you know, different enough that you can still reach people and connect with them, but you avoid anything that resembles cliche. And again, as a journalist, you know, for 35 years and someone who's, you know, bought a few cliches over the years, I, you know, more times than I ever would want to admit, I'm just here to tell you, it's just so difficult to do. There's so much thought and you know, I admire it so much because as a journalist, I'm trained, you know, fast, 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 and you can't dwell, you can't think. And those folks like a Doris Kearns Goodwin who can sit back and crank out a 900-page book or a book of nonconforming prose like 10th of December, I just find it, you know, the older I get, I just am blown away by it. It's just such a remarkable accomplishment. Oh, you know,
what helped me a lot was when I was in my early 30s and we had our kids, I was just failing. I was a tech writer and getting nothing published. I remember at that time we were down to one car, and so I would ride my bike to work along the Erie Canal. And I remember just thinking, wow, I am 32 years old and nothing's happening. Child prodigy years are over. But I also thought, man, I'm so lucky. I have a wife I love. I have kids. So there was a kind of a weird patience or calm that came over me. I'm like, all right, so clearly you're in it for the long game. And you found out that you can live totally happily without any kind of success. So that was kind of powerful to say, take your time. You know, if you only write one good story in your life, then you're still ahead of the game.
And so the success, we just have a few seconds. This hour has gone by very, very quickly. So the success of this book, National Book Award finalist, all kinds of acclaim, how's it making you feel?
Well, it's making me wonder why I was such a loser the previous 53 years.
but what a terrific
it's really
feeling it's got to be for
year.
You.
It's been a great year.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
George Saunders, author of 10th of December. Again, he speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. A chance to go hear a true master. To grab a ticket, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. What a pleasure to have you.
And for me.
Thanks for the time. You bet.